Roosevelt kept up his smiling facade during those introductions at Yalta, but he was hiding a terrible secret. He was being treated for an enlarged heart and congestive heart failure. His doctors took care to ensure that his health condition remained under wraps, but those who knew him well were in no doubt that the president had a life-threatening illness. "I was terribly shocked at the change since our talks in Washington," wrote Averell. "The signs of deterioration seemed to me unmistakable." He was concerned that Roosevelt wouldn't have the stamina to negotiate effectively when dealing with Stalin. Arthur Burse felt the same, having seen the president at close quarters during the Tehran conference. "A man weary in spirit," he wrote, "the good-humored, benevolent uncle had become a shadow of his former self." End quote. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. Episode 95, The Impossible Alliance, Part 2. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on unceded territory of the Anishinaabeg Algonquin people, also called Ottawa, in free, independent, and sovereign Canada. Before I get further, remember that you can support Beyond Barbarossa through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose any level of support you feel comfortable with. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free episodes, plus occasional bonus episodes. This week, we're continuing our look at the Yalta Conference of February 1945, where the big three Allied leaders of the Second World War, that is, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, U.K. Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and Premier of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Joseph Stalin, met and made decisions that determined the shape of the end of the war, and as it turned out, the shape of geopolitics for decades, what's been called the world order. That may sound a little overstated, because, of course, there's going to be a lot of developments after the Yalta Conference and after the end of the Second World War that also contributed to the overall shape of world politics. And this podcast will get to that. But right now, we're focusing on the Yalta Conference of early February 1945 with the leaders of the USSR, the United States, and the United Kingdom and the British Empire. This series started two episodes ago, number 93, which summed up the conference and the major decisions that were made there. That summary left us with a number of questions about just why those decisions were made when they seemed either vague or often contrary to the interests of the United States or United Kingdom and unevenly favorable to Stalin's Soviet Union. And also is perplexing that many of those were not really carried out the way that it would seem they were framed. So if you haven't heard episode 93, I strongly recommend that you pause this episode and go back and listen to it. Also, this episode is a continuation of a conversation that began last episode with Giles Milton, author of a number of books. So if you haven't heard that one, listen to episodes 93 and then 94, and then come back to this one. I'll wait. All caught up? Great. So, again, a quick recap on the top decisions agreed by the leaders of the big three, that is, the United States, United Kingdom, and the Soviet Union. The big one was the demand for Nazi Germany's unconditional surrender. The country would then be split into four occupied zones, one each for the US, UK, the USSR, and, after Stalin grudgingly accepted it, one for France. But that sector would be formed from portions of the U.S. and British zones. Stalin refused to give up any of the territory that would be under his direct control. then Germany would be denazified and demilitarized. War criminals would be tried and sentenced. Prisoners of war and displaced persons, those taken for slave labor in Germany, for example, as well as those who fled the fighting as the front moved, they would all be returned to the countries they came from, whether they wanted to return or not. Another decision was that Germany would pay reparations for the damage it had caused in its war. Originally, some astronomical figure was mentioned, but it was completely unrealistic. So the final decision was some of these reparations would be repaid in the form of forced labor, primarily in the USSR. The next decision was that the countries once occupied or dominated by Nazi Germany in Central and Eastern Europe, from Czechoslovakia to Bulgaria to Greece, would be independent, self-governing, and would have free elections. We'll come back to that. The USSR would join the nascent United Nations, Roosevelt's pet project. The Soviet Union also agreed to join the war against Japan after Germany's defeat, in return for the Kuril Islands and South Sakhalin Island in the North Pacific. And then we get to the most problematic item of discussion at Yalta, Poland. Remember that World War II started when Germany and then the Soviet Union invaded and divided the country between themselves in September 1939. At Yalta, Churchill demanded that Poland be restored to its pre-war borders with a democratic government, starting with the pre-war elected Polish government, then operating in exile in London. Stalin insisted that the post-war border be the so-called Curzon Line, the de facto border between the German and Soviet occupation zones from 1939 to 1941. This meant appropriating territory from eastern Poland into the Lithuanian and Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republics and compensating Poland with German territory on its western side, including about half of East Prussia plus territory to the west, in effect shifting Poland about 150 kilometers westward. In the process, the USSR took Konigsberg, now Kaliningrad, and the Soviet Union also incorporated the three Baltic states it had occupied in 1940. These became the Soviet Socialist Republics of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Churchill argued against these conditions strenuously. As we heard last episode, the British Prime Minister said, quote, "For Great Britain, the fate of Poland is a matter of honor." End quote. Stalin retorted, "If Poland is a matter of honor for Mr. Churchill, it is a matter of life and death for the Soviet Union." Good point. Franklin Roosevelt, the U.S. president, went along with the Soviet leader on this point, as he did with a number of other issues, mystifying not only Churchill and the British delegation, but also his own aides. Stalin grudgingly agreed to free and fair democratic elections in Poland after the war, but as you listeners know, that's not quite how things worked out. In short, Stalin got almost everything he wanted out of the Yalta Conference. The Western Allies did not, especially when it came to issues around Eastern Europe and democracy. Why? To help understand that, I turn to Giles Milton, whose latest book devotes a lot of pages to the Yalta Conference. That book is The Stalin Affair, the impossible alliance that won the war. The opening quote about U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt was taken from that book. As I mentioned last episode, this book is different from most histories I've read about the Second World War and about the Eastern Front. It looks at the relationships that held that impossible alliance together. Last episode, Giles and I spoke about UK Prime Minister Winston Churchill, his ambassador to the Soviet Union, Archie Clark Kerr, and of course the communist dictator, Joseph Stalin. That was a full episode and a fascinating one. Today, Giles and I continue our conversation, focusing on the party to the conference that we didn't quite get to, the United States, and its leader, Franklin Roosevelt, as well as his right-hand man and ambassador to the USSR in 1945, Averell Harriman, and one more person who is often overlooked in the major histories of World War II, but who had a profound impact behind the scenes. So without further ado, let's get into it. Okay, so I did say I wanted to ask about Roosevelt being the missing person, and that we haven't talked about that much yet. But before I do that, there's something else. Your book devoted a fair bit of space to Kathleen Harriman, Kathy or Puff. What drew you to her? Why mention her so much?
So it's important to explain that Kathy Harriman was the daughter of Averell Harriman. Mm-hmm. Averell Harriman was one of America's wealthiest businessmen. He owned the Union Pacific Railroad. Mm-hmm. And he was also a good friend of Roosevelt. And Roosevelt, in 1941, selected Harriman to be his personal emissary to, first of all, to Winston Churchill, and later on to Joseph Stalin. Now, Averell Harriman was, he's just to give a picture of him, he's this incredibly good-looking, very wealthy, very gregarious individual.
Yeah, I hate him.
You know, close friend of the president. He goes over to England, but he wants to take his darling daughter, Kathy Harriman, with him. Kathy Harriman, in 1941, she was a glamorous 23-year-old American socialite. She was a gregarious, she was extremely intelligent, and she was a very glamorous sidekick to her father, but she was ultimately to prove a lot more than that, mm-hmm. because Kathy Harriman is going to play a really, really important role, first in London and then in Moscow, where she accompanies her father to Moscow. She runs the American embassy in Moscow. She's in and out of the Kremlin. She's working for one of the Office of War Information in Moscow alongside Soviets. She's learned fluent Russian. But what's fascinating about her is that she writes hundreds and hundreds of letters home to her sister, principally in New York. And because these are sent via the diplomatic bag, they are uncensored. And so she describes exactly what life was like living in the Churchill household, because she and her father spent most of their time with the Churchills in the early part of the war. And then they spend much of their time with Stalin in the later part of the war. And she writes these extraordinary letters, very colourful, and sort of warts and all. You really get what it's like to be in the room with, you know, Churchill or with Stalin. She mm-hmm. describes it all. So they're so vivid, and it's so rare as a historian to have these intimate portraits of these, you know, great wartime leaders, mm-hmm. that it was a great sort of boon for me to have that when I was writing my book.
That sounds great, because having her there, I think, also brings out so much more, you know, little tidbits. I've also found Averell Harriman a very important and very and fascinating guy. Let's dive deep into that major player in the Yalta Conference right after this short break. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian man, Maurice Bury, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941. Just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. The Eastern Front Trilogy is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941 through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine, and finally, to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find 3 individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase the 3-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburyauthor.com.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halba Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen. Many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Welcome back to episode 95 of Beyond Barbarossa. I'm Scott Burry in the Redbeard studio, talking with Giles Milton about his book, The Stalin Affair, The Impossible Alliance That Won the War, and about the Yalta Conference of February 1945. Giles's book focuses on the people involved in the Big Three Alliance, the US, UK, and USSR. Not only the top leaders, but also others who, just outside the spotlight, had a profound impact on the alliance. People like UK Ambassador Archie Clark Kerr, US Ambassador to the USSR Avril Harriman, and his daughter Kathleen Puff Harriman. I've also found Avril Harriman a very important and fascinating guy. And then reading about his relationship with Churchill's daughter-in-law, Pamela, and the fact that Kathy knew about it and seemed, you know, quite, you know, accepting that, you know, yeah, this is just what daddy does.
It's worth for your listeners pointing out what happened, that within a week of Avril Harriman arriving in England in 1941, he is in bed with the Prime Minister's daughter-in-law. So, you know, they enter into the relationship. So Avril and Pamela Churchill end up in bed together under the Churchill's roof. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. You know, Pamela is married to Churchill's son, you know, and yet he's gone off to war.
Right.
And so she's in bed with Avril Harriman. And we now know that the Churchills, Winston and his wife, knew that this was taking place. And I think they probably thought this was no bad thing. You know, we talk a lot in this country of the special relationship between Britain and America. Well, this was cementing that relationship on a very personal basis.
Yeah, okay, okay. Let's see if we can have more of that. I don't know. I don't think in the current climate, Ed would be quite as accepting. But as you pointed out, the sort of the atmosphere of that level of that, if I may use the word class of people in both the UK and the United States was, yeah, they were promiscuous. And it seemed, yeah, that's just the way things are.
They were. They were simply in and out of each other's bedrooms. Just on the special relationship, of course, we sort of look back at the wartime, certainly in this country, in Great Britain, with sort of slightly rosy tinted, you know, vision of it all. Mm-hmm. In fact, the special relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt was not special at all. They really didn't get on. They didn't see eye to eye anything. They were constantly trying to curry favor with Joseph Stalin. So Roosevelt would try and have private meetings with Stalin. Churchill would try and have private meetings with Stalin and get one up on the other. So yeah, there was this constant competition between Churchill and Roosevelt, which is makes for some very unsavory reading. Well, you know, some of the things I read, Roosevelt deliberately trying to put down Churchill in front of Joseph Stalin.
Right. And then there's the Moscow conference when Churchill traveled to Moscow and wrote his what he called the naughty letter.
This is an extraordinary thing. So this is an example of Churchill trying to get one up on Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. He flies to Moscow in 1944 and tries to do a private deal with Stalin, by which they split up Europe into spheres of influence. And so he literally writes this out on a note. He says to Stalin, well, look, we're not that interested in Romania, so you can kind of have Romania, but we're very, very interested in Greece, so we want Greece.
Right.
And it was literally done on that level, you know. And this is fairly extraordinary, given that Churchill hadn't consulted the British Parliament, he hadn't consulted his ministers. More importantly, he hadn't consulted the people of Eastern Europe and their various governments in exile in London. This was his own initiative between him and Joseph Stalin. And part of the point of it was to get one up on President Roosevelt.
And it was like 50% influence shared between us and you in Romania and 25-75. You know, how would that work?
Well, that's a very good question. He wrote it down on this sheet of paper and he pushed it across the table to Stalin. And Stalin just put a big tick on it, and so he approved of it. But Churchill actually said, you know, this is a very naughty document. It was became known as the naughty document.
Right.
And he said people would be shocked if they saw what we've just done. Well, of course, they would be shocked for the reasons I've set out, because no one had been consulted about this. And ultimately, this whole thing was stillborn anyway, because by the time they came to discuss this further at Yalta in 1945, as I previously said, Stalin's Red Army was already in possession of all these places anyway, you know, so it was too late.
What was Averell Harriman, I think, to me, maybe the most important Western representative in Moscow, especially by the end of the latter years of the war. What was his relationship and what was his impression of Stalin?
So it's very interesting. He arrives in Moscow and is greeted sort of like the multi-millionaire uncle we all wished we had, you know, because Stalin befriends Averell Harriman because he knows two things. Averell has the direct ear of the president, and two, Averell can get things done. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when, you know, the Lend-Lease program is up and running, where this is the base, essentially, it's the United States of America equipping the Soviet Union with vast supplies of military hardware. What does Averell do? He turns around to the Detroit car manufacturers and he says, stop making any cars, start making tanks and planes for the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And because he's got the ear of the president, this happens, you know. And so I think Stalin respected Averell Harriman and indeed Roosevelt in a way that he never respected Winston Churchill. He seemed to sort of like Winston Churchill in a way, but he didn't respect him in the sense that he knew Roosevelt and Averell Harriman could deliver on their promises. Right. When they said, we're going to ship X number of thousand tanks to the Soviet Union, Stalin knew he was going to get them, you know. Mm. And so it was in his interest to befriend Averell Harriman. Mm-hmm. And one other thing I should say about Averell Harriman, because he got to know Stalin extremely well. He was literally in and out of the Kremlin every day. He was one of the key people that said to the powers back in America, do not underestimate Joseph Stalin. You know, he is extremely brilliant at manipulating and getting what he wants. So he constantly was telling them back at home, be careful when you're dealing with this guy.
Okay, really? Okay. So he was very much a realist. I guess he had to be in his position to run a successful railroad.
He was a realist, but he also was one of the very, very few people that knew Stalin intimately. You know, he was holding meetings with him on a pretty much daily basis. So he was really speaking from a position of strength. Like he knew what he was talking about, you know. So it was pretty much too late by the time they started to listen to him back in Washington and realize that he was indeed correct, that Stalin had a master plan for post-war Europe. And that master plan involved the Red Army controlling most of it.
Right, right. So that brings us to my big question. People like Averell Harriman tried to warn Roosevelt about this. But when Roosevelt gets to Yalta in February 1945, he refuses to discuss any presentation or plan for going into the meeting with Churchill. And then he thinks he's going to charm Stalin. He feels, and I think he's probably justified in this, that he can be more charming than Churchill. He is also giving it on to Stalin, especially on Poland. And Harriman, as you point out in the book, says this is a naive way to go about things and is quite disturbed by it. So was it because he was ill at the meeting? I'm not asking you to psychoanalyze a man who's 80 years dead, but really, what do you think was going on with his mind, with his mindset, his intentions at that meeting?
I think it's really important to stress that Roosevelt was not just ill at Yalta, he was dying. He had congestive heart failure, and of course he would be dead. By April, he would be dead. So this is the last couple of months of his life. And when he arrived at Yalta, he arrived at Saki Airport in the Crimea and then was driven to Yalta. Everyone was profoundly shocked when they saw him. His skin was kind of pale, white, yellow. He just looked absolutely dreadful. And indeed, he was so ill that, you know, one of the plenary sessions when they're discussing all of this stuff had to be held in his bedroom with him in bed. He couldn't get out of his own bed, you know. So I think that it's been much underplayed, the fact that he was a very, very sick man when he came to Yalta. He was also staggeringly naive, I think, when dealing with Joseph Stalin. At least that's what all his American aides said. And so, for example, take the Baltic states, you know, this was a very, very important point. What's going to happen to the Baltic states at the end of the war? Stalin says, well, you know, we're in control of them already. The Red Army's in control of them. We'll have a plebiscite. We'll ask the people what they want. And Roosevelt rather naively says, oh, that's a very good idea. That sounds great, you know. And all his aides are sort of banging their heads together, thinking this is a crazy idea. Doesn't he realize that any plebiscite, you know, run by Joseph Stalin is going to go the way that Joseph Stalin wants it to be, you know, to go? And so that was one fundamental error of Roosevelt's, was his naivety. And the second thing that was really shocking to Churchill was he said, we're going to demobilize the American army as soon as we possibly can. And this was music to the ears of Joseph Stalin. There'd no longer be American soldiers in Europe, which meant that the Red Army would be the only surviving military power in Europe, you know. And Churchill himself was profoundly shocked when he heard this, because he just thought, that's terrible. The imbalance of power that's going to leave in Europe is an open invitation to Stalin to take over everything.
Yes. So Roosevelt had to have been informed. I mean, he had to have the same information that Harriman and Churchill and others had, Archie Clark Kerr as well. Did he just sort of put that aside? Did he think he could overcome Stalin's monstrosity?
I mean, Roosevelt, one of his great goals, well, he had two great goals at the Yalta conference, really. The first, and it's very important, and here in Britain we tend to forget it, is that the ongoing war in the Pacific is proving incredibly costly in American lives. And so one of the goals that Roosevelt had was to bring Stalin into the war in the Far East, which on paper at least he's successful, because Stalin agrees to sign up to sending the Red Army to fight that war against the Japanese. The second goal that Roosevelt has, and this is perhaps because of his illness and he knows he's a dying man, is that he believes the new world order is going to be guaranteed by this new organization called the United Nations, which is going to be set up. And he's desperate to get Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union to sign up to the United Nations, which is going to become, if you like, the world's policeman. You know, this is going to look after take care of the world. And in that, he's also successful. So from Roosevelt's point of view, these were his two great goals, and he's got them both, you know. So he feels he's done his bit and he's succeeded. Okay. And also, don't forget, you know, he's deeply hostile to the British Empire, and he'll be very happy to see the demise of the British Empire. And so he's in no way does he want to support Churchill, whose great goal is to preserve the British Empire into the post-war period. So hugely conflicting goals between America and Great Britain in 1945.
Let's take one more short break and then get into some interesting developments after 1945. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome back to episode 95 of Beyond Barbarossa. I'm Scott Burry in the Redbeard studio, talking with Giles Milton about his book, The Stalin Affair, The Impossible Alliance That Won the War, and about the Yalta Conference of February 1945. The British Empire then, as we know, fades away quickly after the Second World War, but it seems into the vacuum comes the Soviet Empire.
That's absolutely true. I mean, you know, Britain is a bankrupt, broken nation at the end of the war, which is, you know, you're not very popular if you say that in Great Britain at the moment, you know, but that's the fact of the matter, is that Britain was bankrupt. You know, our rationing, food rationing went on for another 3 or 4 years after the war's end, you know. So Britain was bankrupt at the end of the war. The empire was teetering on the brink. You know, India would be lost. It's all falling apart. Britain, of course, will be saved by the Marshall Plan, George Marshall's, you know, plan for the resurrection of Europe, the financial resurrection of Europe. One thing that Churchill realizes, with no American troops left in Europe, it's absolutely crucial that Germany has to be rebuilt. And this is an idea that would have been shocking at the Yalta Conference. You know, Germany is going to be kept as this nation that, you know, that can't really economically do anything, you know, is going to be pushed into the ground. Churchill realizes, and this is where there's going to be a great turning point at the beginning of the Cold War, where Churchill says, Germany has to be rebuilt. We need a strong Germany as a counterpoint to the vast force of the Soviet Union. And this is where, again, the Marshall Plan comes in. Right. The German economy is rebuilt and West Germany arises like a phoenix and becomes this great financial superpower.
Right. I don't want to oversimplify it, but Roosevelt knows that he's dying. He doesn't have much time left. So he's got his two goals and the thing that he thinks is going to be the new world order is the United Nations.
Yeah.
So he didn't foresee the rise of a globe-spanning Soviet empire or thought that the UN would be strong enough to counter that.
I think he thought the UN was going to be a much more powerful body than it turned out to be. And I think he genuinely thought, from the private memos and stuff I've read, that he thought the Soviets could be contained. That if you get Stalin to sign up to this new convention, this new world order, this new kind of architecture of the post-war world, then he's going to be working within the system. And once he's in the system, you know, you can keep him sort of on side, if you like.
Right.
Of course, this is not going to work out. The alliance, the wartime alliance, is going to fall apart within a very, very short space of time after the war's come to an end. The Cold War really begins in the shadow of the victory celebrations. It's quite extraordinary how quickly it all turns sour. And clearly, Stalin is intent on becoming a world bully. You know, he's going to throw the weight of the Soviet Union around to get exactly what he wants.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the questions I have for my own podcast is, after the end of the Second World War, what do I do? And the Cold War is sort of beckoning as the subject that makes the most sense. One thing you mentioned before we started recording is the resurgence of Stalin as a cultural figure in Russia under Putin. That, you know, Khrushchev, of course, repudiated Stalin in the 50s. Then by the 90s, when the Soviet Union ended, statues were pulled down and so on. But now he's being reconsidered in Russia.
Yeah, more than that, he's being resurrected. I mean, statues are going up all over the place and they're, you know, they're these vast great monuments and the you know, the priests and bishops and patriarchs of the Orthodox Church turn out to bless these things as they're being unveiled. So I think Putin's goal is to hark back to this period in the Second World War. This is the great struggle for survival. This was the Russia not the Soviet Union. He never mentions the Soviet Union. He always talks about Mother Russia. You know, Mother Russia survived against all the odds. And because Stalin was leading Mother Russia at that time, he has become a useful figurehead to be resurrected. And yeah, there are statues. It's quite extraordinary. Statues going up all over Russia in now under the auspices of Vladimir Putin to celebrate this great moment in Russian history as he sees it.
Just mind-blowing. So I guess also that we would require some suppression of some aspects of history to rebuild that image of Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, but the Russians are very good at this. I mean, Stalin did it himself during the war. You know, there's an extraordinary moment in about 1942, 1943, where he realizes that a lot of Russians, they will not fight for the Communist Party, but they will fight for Holy Mother Russia, as he sees it. And so suddenly there's this great change. He doesn't mention the Communist Party anymore. He gets rid of his portraits of Karl Marx and, you know, of Engels and all these people, and he replaces them with the old Tsarist generals. It's quite extraordinary. The British ambassador goes into Joseph Stalin's study at one point, and all the old pictures have been taken down, and he's looking at all these portraits of the Tsars and his generals and everything. Mm. And so Stalin was not averse to rewriting history or resurrecting ghosts from the past when it suited him. You know, he would never have done this a few years earlier, but he realized it was in his interest to get the people behind fighting for Holy Mother Russia. And so that's precisely what he did. And I think, yeah, Putin's doing a very, very similar thing now as well.
Yeah, totally, really, really frightening in many ways. We're coming close to the end of our time. So I'm going to ask you, you mentioned you were in Ottawa to research another book. So can you tell the listeners what they can look forward to from the pen of or the typewriter of Giles Milton?
This is a big Arctic adventure. It's a story from the early years of the 20th century of an explorer who tried to claim the entire high Arctic for the British Empire. He was a visionary. He believed that the future of the world would depend on the rare metals, the oil and the gas that was available in the Arctic. And he also, being a very good friend of the Wright brothers, who'd invented the aeroplane, he realized that the flight times from, for example, from Great Britain to Japan were slashed by thousands of miles if you could fly over the North Pole. Mm. And in those days, of course, you had to refuel planes every few hundred miles. And so he said the islands of the Arctic were going to become incredibly important in the future. And so he launches this extraordinary adventure to try and not only claim these islands, but colonize them. And that is where it all went very badly wrong. And happily, in the archives in Ottawa are many, many of the documents that I needed to tell this story.
Wow. And can you tell us the name of this adventurer?
He is called Stephenson. He was born William Stephenson. He changed his name to Stephenson. I can't even pronounce his first name. He's sort of Vilhelmr, because he wanted to sound more like a Viking. He was of Icelandic origin originally, from hundreds of years back. He was very proud of his Viking roots, and so he changed his name to Stephenson. And he's a fascinating character. He was made into a celebrity by the press, and the press would perhaps, for people reading my book, will find out whether or not the press were to spell his downfall in the end. But he was certainly a visionary, and given that all the noises that Trump is currently making towards Greenland, he had a very similar attitude to the importance of these places in the high Arctic. So I think it's going to be quite a topical book. I wasn't expecting it to be very topical, but I think it is going to be.
Yes, a lot of focus on the Arctic. And another William Stephenson. So that's three.
Yes, that's true, actually. You're right.
Wow.
He was one of the great celebrity explorers of his age. And because of what happened up in the high Arctic, I won't give up too much away. Because of that, no one these days has heard of him. But I can assure you, in 1918, if you mentioned the name Stephenson, everyone would have heard of him. He was a household name around the globe.
And when can we expect this book?
Well, all being well, it will come out in spring, exactly a year from now, actually. Okay. In Britain, it's John Murray, which I think the Canadian edition will be John Murray. And in America itself, it will be published by Henry Holt.
And what's the name of the book, the title?
It's called, at the moment, and it could change, but my title is Island of Ghosts. One Man's Obsession with the Remotest Place on Earth is the subtitle.
Thanks very much, Giles. We'll all look forward to Island of Ghosts.
Well, thanks very much for having me on as well.
It's been tremendous. We've reached the end of this three-part series into the Yalta Conference. Thanks one more time to my gracious guest, Giles Milton. I put links to his website and many interesting books in the show notes and on the webpage for this episode. Just go to beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com and click on the title for this episode, number 95, The Impossible Alliance, Part 2. And thank you, listeners. I also want to make a special thanks to all the Patreon patrons. Until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. If you're not doing so already, please consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app. Just hit that follow button. And I really appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen. And if you have a couple of minutes, a brief review on any of those platforms would help let others who are interested in this part of history know about us. Do you have a question, a comment, something to add? I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me by email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You can also find me, Scott Burry, author, on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Threads. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina. Viva le Canada.